Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Metastatic Urothelial Bladder Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Michael van der Heijden from the Netherlands Cancer Institute in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. In addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. van der Heijden's slide presentation. To begin, he commented on the bladder cancer tumor microenvironment and how it might relate to response to immune checkpoint inhibition.
The microenvironment in bladder cancer, actually, you can divide it up very simply in three big groups. So one is the inflamed microenvironment, where you would expect a response to checkpoint inhibition. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the desert microenvironment, where you hardly see any immune cells. In those patients, you would not expect to see a response to a checkpoint blockade. And in the middle, and that's quite a big group for bladder cancer, there's the excluded phenotype, in which there are immune cells, but they're mostly at the edge of the tumor. And I think those are the ones where most of the increments in immunotherapy response may be reached. I think another couple of features that I think are important are TLS, so that's tertiary lymphoid structures, which is basically very small lymph nodes that are on the edge of the tumor, and that we are thinking that that's where priming occurs, so that's where the immune response maybe starts. And I think another feature that may be important but is still not very explored are inhibitory components of the microenvironment. So one of them that could go either way is macrophages. Another one that I think for bladder cancer is very important is TGF-beta signaling by fibroblasts. So fibroblasts can occur and seem to have perhaps an inhibitory influence on the immune response.
Any comment on the correlation between PD-1 levels, TMB levels, and benefit bladder cancer and even beyond bladder cancer? How much of an issue do you think is dynamic change, that maybe these things were measuring change over time? How much of an issue is that, do you think?
Yeah, I think for tumor mutation burden, that's, in my view, not that much of an issue, in the sense that it's quite a stable biomarker, only everybody measures it in a different way, and it's still difficult to put a line and say everybody above this line will respond and everybody below this line will not. So it's not that simple. It's in the end just basically a derivative of how many new antigens you probably have. For PD-L1, it's more difficult. There might be dynamic changes. It might make a difference where you determine it. And I think in a lot of the studies, PD-L1 as a biomarker has been difficult and complicated. So this remains a problematic biomarker.
I also wanted to get a little bit of input from you regarding toxicity of IOs. And again, I see this really cool paper you have here looking at treatment patterns and survival outcomes of patients admitted to the intensive care unit for immune-related. I thought that was really interesting. I haven't seen a paper like that, and I was curious about what you saw there, and also your perspective about management of immune-related adverse events, and how that goes in a tertiary center like yours. You may have a whole team that does that compared to being out in the community. How you see people in emergency rooms, being aware of IREs, and also what you saw here. One of the things I thought was interesting is how many people you had with diabetic ketoacidosis as a reason. I never kind of thought about that. I thought that was interesting. The other stuff wasn't quite as surprising. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think for our center, we've worked with immunotherapy for a very long time, and it's a very big part of what we do. We are a very big melanoma center, especially. So we not only treat a lot with immunotherapy, but especially a lot with combination therapies, where we see more intense immune toxicity than with monotherapy. We also do a lot of cell therapy, so we're really used to this toxicity. So it's a bit easier for us to talk about how to do this. But I think in the end, the very most important thing in managing toxicity of immune-related events is early recognition, that people who are dealing with a patient know that they're dealing with a potential immune-related event and are taking appropriate action. And that's where everything starts. And I think that's where it has gone wrong sometimes in the past. I remember from when we first started with anti-CTLA-4 that we, you know, admitted a lot of patients with diarrhea or with potential hypophysitis. And these are all toxicities that we now virtually always treat in an outpatient setting. And this has really changed. And I think the what you see in the ICU, what we wrote our paper about, that's just the tip of the iceberg in a tertiary center. And ketoacidosis is something that can just occur really fast, and then might end up a patient and ends up on the ICU. But it's also, you know, it's not pleasant to have diabetes for the rest of your life, of course. But usually we can save these patients.
Yeah, I was kind of curious what happened. I think you had 8 patients with ketoacidosis, and you mentioned how quickly it was. But I mean, in retrospect, could you see it symptomatically, or it just came on so fast that, you know, we required being in the ICU?
Yeah, I think for all these patients, it came really fast, and a couple of patients of mine jumped to mind that I've seen, and it was just incredibly fast. And I think maybe one of the reasons is that we've really, well, I would almost say pioneered new adjuvant immunotherapy, and our center had a lot of our studies with combination immunotherapy, and it seems that perhaps in a new adjuvant setting, immune-related toxicity can sometimes be a bit faster and a bit more severe, and maybe that's a reflection why we had a few patients on the ICU with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. And actually, I was going to ask you, you mentioned you do a lot of melanoma, and I was curious what you all thought about the NADINA trial presented at ASCO, neoadjuvant, and whether you think that, you know, incredible story they told there, you maybe could get repeated with bladder.
Yeah, I think that has been an incredible story, and I think this is huge credits to the investigator. You don't see that very often, that people build up this therapy from the ground. And of course, these are therapies that are made by pharma, but the whole trajectory is basically done in academic trials. And I think that's a fantastic accomplishment that has led to this really great trial, where for the majority of patients, you actually can only give two cycles in the neoadjuvant setting, and that's it for them. So for bladder cancer, we've been working a lot with anti-CTLA-4 as well. I think the story is a bit complicated in that sense, that definitely for bladder cancer, you need a high dose of anti-CTLA-4 to increase response rates in comparison to monotherapy. And of course, bladder cystectomy is a very big surgery. So what we see is still really good response rates, pretty much the same as with melanoma. So half of the patients has a complete response, even in stage 3 bladder cancer, which is a very extensive disease already. But we also see quite a bit of toxicity. And coming back to the discussion we just had, I think in our center, we can manage to keep these patients on track and get them to surgery still at a reasonable time. But I think if this is done, if this would become standard care, or even in a global trial, I think we would see some problems with these patients going for this big surgery just after combination immunotherapy.
Yeah, I saw that you had done some work with Durva-Tremi, which is, you know, usually hear more about Ipi-Nivo. Of course, in HCC, you have Durva-Tremi, and it's been interesting there. They didn't use it exactly the same way as, you know, with Ipi-Nivo. They saw less toxicity. What are you seeing with when you do that type of combination in terms of IREs?
So I think for Tremi, the difficulty is so ipilimumab in metastatic setting for a lot of tumor types is ipi 3 mg/kg and only a few indications 1 mg/kg. I think for tremelimumab, quite early made a decision to continue with 1 mg/kg. Of course, these are different antibodies, so you cannot immediately compare. But if you look at the toxicity, I would say that Tremi 1 mg/kg is sort of equivalent to Ipi 1 mg/kg. And I think for urothelial cancer, it has missed the mark, maybe because it was just the dose was too low. So I think with the dosage we used, for example, in the Danube trial, I think toxicity was quite manageable. And was not as much as what we've been seeing in our Nabucco trial, for example, with Ipi 3.
when you use it neoadjuvantly, how many doses do you use? Because with HCC, which is, you know, metastatic, they just gave it once.
Yeah, so we've tested in one of our trials, so that was in the metastatic setting. We also, because of those results, tested it with that schedule. I think for the neoadjuvant schedule, there is a trial with Trami where they gave, I think, two courses of Tremi-Durva, but at a lower dose. We gave Ipi-Nivo basically, well, we used a couple of different schedules, but basically two times the combination. And then we still gave one course of Nivo in those patients.
So I know you're focused on first-line therapy in Mets, but you know, I did want to ask you about these neoadjuvant questions as well. Maybe we'll get into that after or during your talk as well. But I'm also curious to what extent there's been discussion about using cell-free DNA or, you know, MRD-type strategy in the neoadjuvant setting to try to determine even maybe whether people go for cystectomy.
No, absolutely. I think that's so what we are having now. So we have now much improved systemic therapy. And we, with ctDNA, we have a great way of monitoring disease. And what we've done in our Nabucco trials is that we tested plasma ctDNA and urine ctDNA to see if it if clearance would track with complete response, and it did. It predicted very nicely, and it also tracked with overall clinical outcome. So I think it's also in a new adjuvant setting a very good marker. We found that urine ctDNA was a bit more difficult than plasma. Basically, you look at sort of different things. So, for example, patients who still have CIS can still have positive urine ctDNA in our study, whereas patients who do not who have CIS won't have plasma ctDNA. And at the same time, also, if you have a bladder complete response, you can clear your urine ctDNA, but if you still have a micrometastasis in your lymph nodes, you may still be you might miss that with your urine ctDNA, of course. So it's measuring different things, but I think when we've sorted this out a bit more, this would be a great way to combine it with very highly active systemic induction therapy. And I think those patients who clear DNA and seem to have a complete response, they could have, you know, de-escalate their local regional therapy and maybe don't need to have surgery in the end. But these are all trials that we are doing and that we need to do more. For example, we are doing a trial with Ipi-Nivo and then followed by chemo-RET, and we're also measuring ctDNA there. And I think there's other trials that are doing similar things, and I think this is very important for patients.
Actually, I was just flashing on another thing I read that you did. I think it was actually on TAR-200, but what was interesting to me there was why people didn't go for cystectomy. And I figured most of them were going to be, you know, medically not eligible, but I guess most of them were eligible, just didn't want to do it.
Yeah, so I think for TAR-200, there's a couple of settings where it's being tested. So one is, and that's where I've been most active, is the non-muscle invasive space. And I think that's the most logical setting to test this. And there, of course, we, you know, patients, as long as they have options, they really don't like to get cystectomy for obvious reasons. And usually, once they're not offered new options anymore, they will eventually go for cystectomy. For the muscle invasive setting, there's also been some really nice results, and I guess the trials are ongoing. And there are some bladder sparing IDs there that are being tested, and I think we have to see the data, but that also looks very interesting.
No, I mean, what my comment related to that was just that there are a lot of people who are eligible for cystectomy that don't want to have it. So, you know, if with neoadjuvant therapy and whatever, MRD, et cetera, they can avoid cystectomy, I'm sure they'd be, a lot of people would be very happy. One final question I have to ask you about. I saw a press release about neoadjuvant Durva chemo. I'm not sure. I don't think I've seen it presented. Are you involved with that?
Yeah, I'm involved with that, I think it was great news. So we have several phase 3 trials going on in the new adjuvant setting, and the first wave, so to say, is with chemo with or without checkpoint inhibition. Later, we'll also see EV with Pembro trials probably coming up a bit later. But these trials have been ongoing for a number of years, and it was great news to see that it was not only positive for event-free survival, but also for overall survival. And that's it sounds trivial, but that's very important, because a lot of the trials in other cancer types were only positive for event-free survival and did not read out on overall survival, or were not positive yet, or took and are still, you know, requiring follow-up for a very long time before they get to the point of OS. So I think this was very striking about the press release.
Yeah, but there's a fair amount of information in that press release, and we were looking at it going, this looks like it could be practice-changing. Do you think it could be?
Yeah, I'm biased, of course. I'm part of the study, but I think this is an important. We have an significant EFS benefit and a significant OS benefit according to the press release. And I would be surprised if the data would not show that this is practice changing. But for now, we are only can talk about the press release, of course.
That's all of our hopes.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we'll see. All right. But no, that looks really exciting anyhow. So, and, you know, getting back to your cell-free DNA thing too, I was thinking also, like with the adjuvant, I think Atezo trial, they showed cell-free DNA kind of work there. So it seems like that could be a promising other end to this thing.
Yeah, and it makes total sense. So in the IMvigor 010 at atezolizumab, which was a negative trial, they showed that in the group of patients who cleared ctDNA after surgery did really well, and the patients who did not clear ctDNA after surgery, they had a benefit of atezolizumab, even though the overall trial was negative. So I think that's very striking news, and I think this should force the other trials to do the same thing and show us their data. And I think this would be completely rational to measure ctDNA after surgery and base decision on that. Of course, we would like to see that in a prospective trial, but I think if several of these adjuvant trials show the same thing and it is available, which it is in the US, I think that would make sense. There is actually just some prospective trials going on as well with atezolizumab basing the decision on ctDNA positivity.
So just out of curiosity, if you had a patient who got neoadjuvant therapy, I don't know if it matters what kind of neoadjuvant therapy, but if they had a path CR, if they had a cell-free DNA that was negative, would you be comfortable observing them rather than having them go for cystectomy?
Yeah, so we're actually in the Netherlands, like a few other countries, are very fond of chemoradiotherapy, and so what we're doing is we're using in the new adjuvant setting a standard care only chemotherapy still, I guess like everybody else. And if patient on scan seems to respond well and has good bladder function, then we often offer still chemoradiotherapy to patients. And I think that's very doable and works well. There's a lot of excitement now based on a trial which used new adjuvant chemotherapy plus nivolumab to look at the pure clinical complete responses and not do any consolidative treatment. I think that's very interesting as well. However, at the end of the day, you will have the group of patients who still keeps their bladder and has no recurrence is a relatively small group. So I think if you would really, the goal is to increase bladder preservation, then maybe it's better to just use chemoradiotherapy. But that's different approaches that are being tested now, and all of these approaches have their advantages and disadvantages.
The Nivo chemo neoadjuvant, has that reported at all?
It has not reported yet, no. But of course, based on the first line metastatic setting and the results we're seeing now from Niagara, I think our hopes are high that's positive as well. But for now, it hasn't read out.
You mentioned enfortumab plus IR, enfortumab pembro. I guess we would anticipate this would be more active in the neoadjuvant setting.
Yeah, I would think so. Based on the metastatic setting, you would think this would be very active. So this is also a very very exciting trial that still needs to read out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be very interested in that one as well. You've got a couple of cases to talk about. Let's talk about this 61-year-old woman.
So this is a patient that I'm still treating. So this is a patient who started with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, had a cystectomy at that point, a T0. But 3 years later, she had to have a nephrectomy and lymph node dissection for upper tract cancer, and this turned out to be T3 and to your upper tract urothelial carcinoma. This patient then went on to have liver and lymph node metastases 5 months after surgery. And this patient was treated with EV plus pembrolizumab. So this is a scan of her baseline situation with several liver metastases visible. And after a few cycles of EV plus pembrolizumab, her liver metastases actually responded very nicely, and she still had some remaining lesions, for example, an intrapelvic metastasis, which was also responding. So no clear signs of active disease at that point. Now, here I'm putting this detailed list of the further follow-up, because I think this is very instructive how this treatment usually develops. So after about 4 months, this patient started to develop grade 1 to 2 toxicity. So asthenia, which is quite common, mucositis, a bit less common, but still happens with this treatment. Neuropathy, grade 1 at that point, dry eyes. When she continued treatment, toxicity worsened, although it was still grade 1 to 2. But because it was affecting her quality of life, we started to dose reduce to 1 milligram per kilogram. And actually, we thought, and I think that's how I discussed this with the patient, this is probably the beginning of the end. Because usually you start with a dose reduction and then a dose delay and then another dose reduction. And eventually you have to conclude that it's no longer possible to continue. But this patient actually, to my surprise, managed to continue. She had some eye complaints and mainly dry eyes, had some lubricants for her eyes, and then actually even had a cataract that developed. I'm not sure if this is treatment related. It's not a typical AE, of course, but she still had surgery for this cataract because she was still in remission. And after 24 months, she was still continuing EV and pembrolizumab. So pembrolizumab had to be discontinued after 2 years. And we had a conversation about whether to continue EV. At that point, she was being honest to herself that actually the EV had really impacted on her overall quality of life, especially the long period of treatment. And we together decided that we would discontinue EV. Unfortunately, this patient, after 8 months, developed a progressive supraclavicular lesion. And I think the question here is, what are the treatment options for this patient? And of course, we've heard about a lot of systemic treatment options, and I'm now just assuming we have everything available. However, in this patient, it was only one metastasis progressing. The other metastases were all in remission. So local therapy, I think, is also an option. And for systemic therapy, we could switch to platinum-based chemotherapy. If possible, resume EV plus pembrolizumab, or maybe check for an FGFR mutation. Actually, what we did in this patient is that we did decide to give local therapy to the supraclavicular metastasis. And I'm in general not an enormous believer in metastasis-directed therapy, but I think for especially patients who are IO treated, it can occur that they have one escaping lesion, and I think there are still good reasons to try to treat that locally. I don't go on for a very long time administering local treatments, but I think in this type of case, I think this is reasonable, and I've had some patients who have done really well after treating one such a metastasis, if the other ones remain in remission.
How long has it been since she got the treatment to the supraclavicular area?
Actually, that's happening now, so I cannot tell you
really?
The outcome, unfortunately.
Interesting. No, I was going to say, I don't know if it would help or not, but do you get an IHC on her? For her, too?
No, I didn't do that yet. So I think, as you'll see in the next patients, we generally reserve fresh frozen treatment for mutation screening. We do that in our institute with whole genome sequencing. But We did keep some tissue, and I think she has several of standard lines of therapies to go. But in the end, perhaps if she's HER2 positive, then that would certainly be an option, and to see if she can get on a trial somewhere.
You know, one thing about her case that a little bit surprised me is it sounds like her quality of life issues, a lot of it had to do with ophthalmic issues, which I know it happens, but I didn't kind of realize it can be this problematic.
Yeah, that's right. And in the beginning, we were very concerned with more severe ophthalmological problems. In the end, I think this is quite rare. It does occur, but usually it's just related to dry eyes in this grade one or two. I think what we see here, and that's, you know, in the end, it's just all accumulating, and then it's which one at some point reaches a threshold where it's really bothering a patient. And it, in this case, it was for some periods in her treatment, it was the dry eyes, although there were other periods where it was quite okay. So, but this is what we've been seeing. And patients had to go to the ophthalmologist for the trial all at the beginning of treatment.
All right, let's finish out with your 63-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is a patient who had extensive metastases of urothelial cancer at their primary diagnosis, liver metastases, lung metastases. And this patient had received chemotherapy at another hospital, cisplatin gemcitabine, and had stable disease. So he then resumed maintenance avelumab. However, after 3 months, he had progression disease after initiation of avelumab. And this patient was referred to our hospital to start enfortumab vedotin, as in the Netherlands, enfortumab vedotin is only given at designated expert centers. So, and this patient actually had a mixed response with some progressive lesions, but most of the lesions remaining stable, actually also some patients who are responding a bit. But especially this one liver metastasis was increasing, and for this reason, we still kept him for a bit on EV, but we did DNA sequencing to determine his genetic profile. And this patient had an ERBB2 activating mutation. Actually, he also had some other mutations that are difficult to target. And no FGFR mutation. So that was actually, for me, the main reason to do this, because we can still get erdafitinib in an expanded access program. But unfortunately, this patient did not have it. So the question here is, what are our options? I think continuing EV is an option, as his overall metastatic progression is not very clear yet. Has a lot of metastases, and a lot of these are not really progressing. I think another option, if you're in the U.S., would be sacituzumab govitecan. I think after the results of the phase 3 trial, I would have some serious doubts if that would be a good idea. I think the third option here would be to test for HER2. I think we often see the patients, of course, with amplifications of ERBB2, but also of mutations, sometimes have overexpression of their HER2 mutants. So this might be a candidate to test HER2 on. At this point, I'm still continuing enfortumab vedotin, and we do have a trial lined up directed at this HER2 mutation.
Did the NGS show any HER2 amplification?
It was not reported, so I guess not, no.
I love this case because I think you can make an argument to treat based on the mutation. I mean, that's what they do in lung cancer. They give it first line in lung cancer. I ask the breast cancer people because they hardly ever see mutations. They don't know what to do. But yeah, if I were this patient, if I really ran out of options, you know, it should respond to mutations, I guess. I mean, it does in lung for sure. I don't know about that particular one, but in general.
Yeah, so that's very curious, that situation in lung. So I think that's what's indeed interesting at this case. This might very well be that this patient also has overexpression. But indeed, this is definitely something to figure out. It's not really, you know, I cannot really completely understand it, why a mutation would respond better to this drug. You would, you know, it goes for the expression of the protein. maybe there's also some inhibition of the ERBB2 mutant, even though that's also generally not observed with antibodies. It's a strange situation that this works for lung cancer, but yeah, maybe.
Yeah, no, that's when I saw that case come up, I thought that was what you were going to say, that you gave the patient TDXD and they responded. I was all excited because I've never seen that outside of lung cancer, but let me know if this patient ever gets to that point. I'll be real curious whether or not the patient whether the patient would respond. Like you say, a lot of these mutation patients have high HC too, so then it would make it easy.
I think maybe one of the lessons from this webinar is also that you guys in the US are lucky with all the with all the treatments you can offer to your patients, because a lot of these treatments for us, we have to find trials to do this.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Vander Heyden, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.